Dan. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Just pleased to open up the meeting of the Audit and Risk Subcommittee of the 8th of March 2017. Just reminding everybody that this meeting is recording, I think, Lauren. And certainly, welcome to everybody, and thank you to the Council for your reappointment of me to this committee. I'm certainly looking forward to the next 3 years with you. I think there's some really interesting things happening, and hopefully through the processes of this committee that we'll enjoy a good triennium. Welcome, as we don't have any staff other than Peter and Mick, but welcome to those. I think other than that, those are the formal formalities in terms of the recording, Laura. So if we just move to the agenda. Apologies. Michael is, Councillor Laws is now here, and I think Councillor Robertson is going to...
Yes, I was going to leave early, just before 2:30.
Okay. Those could be noted, Laura, and I think Mr. Bodeker has to be somewhere later in the day as well. Okay, we just then move through confirmation of the agenda. That's in front of us. Conflict of interests, if there is any. There being none. We move on then to the first item on the agenda.
Dave. Just one thing. I note we don't have the minutes of the previous meeting. And I guess that might be a full process where it's signed off with the Finance and Court Committee, but it would be useful to have them just to as a refresher in the future. Yep. If we don't do the signed Motherita, so is that right?
Normally we do.
No, we don't, because at the end of the triennium, the last meeting of all of council and all committees is signed off is signed off by the Chief Executive. So those minutes have been done, and we can circulate them, but they don't have to come back to this meeting meeting now, because it's a new committee meeting.
It's more from a refresher.
Yes, I agree, councillors. I think it would be a good idea at least to have them in the pack so we can note those. Okay, let's.
Mr. Chairman, before you carry on, you asked if there was anything to do with the agenda. I sent you some items.
Yes.
Okay. Are they?
If the committee is happy, I think we'll address the moving into PE item that you mentioned when we get to those resolutions, which once we get to that point, then we can have the discussion then. In terms of the two items relating to the building and the water plan, which, as I understood from your email, Councillor, that they are risk-related items. I think Mr. Donnelly is covering risk elements in his director's report, and I think we can cover those items when we get to that, if you're happy with that.
Oh, sure. So, because there is a number of items that I want to raise at that point related to risk that aren't on this agenda.
Yes, and I think it'd be useful at that time for Mr. Donnelly to run through broadly the risk framework that you have in this council and the processes around that. So we do need an update, Nick, don't we, on that, and then indeed in terms of the elements of risk itself, where clearly there are a number. So if you're happy with that, we'll proceed into item one, which is the health and safety report. Mr. Donnelly, are you going to just take us through that?
I'll take it as read. This report's actually been reviewed by our HR manager, but you know, between myself and Peter, I'm sure we could answer any further questions on it.
Okay, open to questions, comments. Councillor Woodhead.
Mr Chairman, the just noting on the graphs there, and the incident reports and new misses with the emergency management of Targo. So that's encapsulating the staff around the region now?
Correct. So that's just the greater group than the three of our older staff. So it's the regional staff as well.
It's the regional staff as well. So there's seven in that group in total, wasn't it?
Yes, correct. Yep.
Yeah. I just, looking from a total staff group across the whole organisation, it sort of stands out a wee bit, that portion of staff, that's all.
But couple of with respect, that group is the environmental monitoring. It's got the same acronym,
Correct, right. That answers that. So I don't.
So they're our field staff, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. I just looked up the email and said emergency management of Targo, but it's not. It's the wider. Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Councillor Kempton.
Yeah. Just first of all, I think it's a really good start because I've been commenting about our approach to health and safety for some time. I've been waiting on some stuff to come forward. I think it's really good. The approach is certainly very good, just a couple of things, and it's only one of them's only a matter of format. Now, when you've got that hazard 10 working in or near water, there's a format involved there that doesn't line the controls up with the hazard. It's just the way it's set up, whereas the one below does. And if I might suggest, the one below is a whole lot easier to, it paints a better immediate picture of that. But that's only a matter of matter of format. The other thing was too that I guess that we, I can't have everything at once. But the important point I think is that we need to be aware of the maintenance regime, and I'm thinking about things like your hazard risk, just keep it alive. And absolutely, and I think that it needs to be pretty transparent how that happens, and to make sure, and also, of course, that being alive, of course, make sure that the people who need to be able to see it, register it, or maybe respond to it, so that's just another limb on the beast, I guess. And some of that work may have already been done, but I think that needs to be as transparent as the documentation that's below. And the other one, which I'm sure that our staff are onto this, of course, is probably the hardest area in all of it also is the contractor accreditation and making sure that they're up to scratch. I know that many organisations I've been involved in this got external contractors, that's about the hardest thing in the world to be able to satisfy yourself you've got covered. And it may well be that some work going on there already, but I think how that occurs, it would be really good for that to come forward at least to this committee. So just in terms of the major key points around the maintenance of the program and the key points around external contractors, I'd like to see a bit of as they develop. Thank you.
If I may just comment, and thank you, Councillor, for that feedback. It's appreciated. The contractor accreditation is certainly well underway, and we can report on that next time. If you happen upon someone in the building who's a contractor, they'll be wearing the hivers with ORC contractor written on the back of it, so very clearly define who they are. The other area that we are working on that I just want to note is the relationship between ourselves when we and or our contractors are working on in someone else's PCBU. So when we're on a farm, the farmer has some the landowner has some responsibilities and we have some responsibilities. We are in a slightly different position to many other people who go onto farms, is that we have the ability to enter under our licences in many cases. So it's marrying that relationship together, and we've had some farmers who have come to us and said, "You'll sign this document that's been prepared by my lawyer before you're allowed to enter," and that normally includes you must make contact with us before you do anything on my farm, and under a regulatory basis that we operate in, or an emergency operation, that's just not possible. So that's a big, big piece of work, because essentially it will require us to have an interaction with every landowner. So that's the other bit, that's the third leg of the things that we're working on.
Yeah, through you, Mr. Chair, has anybody else solved that yet?
Well, I know our HR and health and safety people are working with the rest of the regional sector on that.
Good, thank you.
I was just thinking, this is probably a small matter, but for councillors themselves to understand what their responsibilities are for health and safety when not only on the site, but perhaps meetings outside. We obviously, as Councillor Kempton was speaking about, need to have available to people their obligations and understanding of how they'll be supported, but also for councillors, where that responsibility sits. Sometimes we are even working almost as contractors when we're commissioners, or there's a whole range of different settings, I suppose, we operate under as governance as well.
Can I pick up that point? Because I think Richard raised a very good point, and I want to make the point you noted in minutes. The councillors are also part of the Otago Regional Council. So staff that are protected by various statutes and policies, that extension and that courtesy should also extend to elected members. And I want to clarify that, because at the moment I'm not sure that is the case. So can we get some clarification around that?
Can you provide that, Peter?
Yes, we will, certainly.
You don't know at the moment, Peter?
No, councillors are contractors, independent contractors, so you're not members of staff. And under the legislation, as I understand it, you're as you would be a director of a non-local government organisation, but without that liability. So you have a different relationship. You're not staff. But what protection the organisation needs to provide, if any, and whether it's aligned to what the staff have, is something that I'm checking.
Well, the reason that I advocate that it should be is because regional councillors are conducting business on behalf of the Otago Regional Council. It is their responsibility.
So you're looking into that, Peter, then?
So will there be a report coming back to the next day with no risk on that, will there?
I would imagine it would be before that, but certainly I will report back to this committee, seeing it's been raised here.
If I can just ask through the chair, are we talking about things like directors and officers' liability insurance, or are we talking about things like behaviours, the way we act, the way we relate?
No, I'm talking about safety and security, all the same provisions that apply to staff members, all the same protections and privileges and rights. I can't see any reason why they should not also equally be extended to those who act on behalf of the council, as obvious as the government's governments.
If you can provide that clarity at least to this committee anyway, I think that would be good. Mr. Bodie. Councillor Brown, you anything?
Oh, yeah, I was just wondering, just generally, in terms of health and safety in the organisation, have we had good buy-in generally from staff? Obviously, there's a lot of documentation and processes we've had to go through to get to this stage. Just a general thing.
Yeah, I mean, we've employed a health and safety officer. She's a mature woman who's come out of Mighty 10, so she's been used to working with sort of shopfront shop floor people, so so she has a good rapport with our field staff in particular, but also right throughout the organisation. So the feedback I'm getting from the staff is that her work is not intrusive. She's firm and expects our compliance to be seen. We made some big changes. Councillors that have been around a while will know that we've made big changes as a result of the Becker work that was done. We bought motorbike trailers where in the past we'd have them on the back of trucks. We paved our depot yards where in the past we had shingle. All of those things had a major health and safety component. So I think we've done our bit, and I see, my observation is the staff are responding. You know, and my ex officio role on the Staff Health and Safety Committee, you know, there are more ideas coming forward to protect staff than we can handle with the staff that we've got. They're good ideas, but they're reasonable as well. For example, we discussed at the last health and safety meeting whether our compliance staff should have cameras on their vests, and so we went and asked the staff, and they felt that might well be a little antagonistic to people, especially people that are aggravated. But we had a really good discussion. So it wasn't just that every idea gets passed. We had a really good discussion. So they bought in all right, and they felt that with aggravated members of the public, we've got a relationship with the police, and we've had a discussion at the highest level locally with the police that they are right there to back us up. So any problem, bring up the police. So that's the sort of message we've got. And yeah, so I'm confident that we've got a good buy-in.
If I could add to that, Councillor Brown, Mr. Bodecker, would you like to give us some insight into what you think the culture is, how that's evolving in the organisation around, I think it's what Councillor Brown was talking about, and I've noticed that elsewhere you might have all the documentation in the world, but it sort of needs to be ingrained in the brains of people that this is the way we work around here. How would you say that is evolving here?
I think we've been fortunate that historically we've had and they're not risk averse, but they're just risk aware people in the hydrology team, which is a team that have, you know, are in and around water all the time. And you know, again, the policies and the practices around staff interacting on a compliance and inspection basis has always been any problems, walk out, back out, no problem with that, and seek help. So I think the culture was always there. We've just formalised it a little bit more. And you know, when I arrived 4.5 years ago, when it was, I was impressed with the way we did that. I mean, you know, and it's the staff suggestions that they always wear hybrids. You know, now for many staff or many groups, that wouldn't be a suggestion. So we're now looking at T-shirts for the summer that are just hybrids T-shirts. So instead of having a bright green collar, they're a bright green shirt. So that's coming back through the staff, and it's not just the zealots in the group. It's pretty general right throughout that group of staff.
Oh, that's good to hear. If I could just add one quick other bit of information that you might like to look at with my experience elsewhere and in the Port of Wellington. You may have heard there was a tragedy there recently where a guy apparently fell off a ladder. It's a bit unsure as to what happened, but died as a result of a head injury. Ladders, an interesting accessory to workplaces, and WorkSafe have banned that and has on the port for a period and was looking seriously at banning per se. So I would suggest it might well be useful to review your processes around the use of ladders, working at heights, I'm sure you've got good procedures there, and indeed, as this chap was, working alone, because he was found on the ground and no one knows CCTV or anything, so it's
I mean, if I can speak again, I mean the resourcing work that we're currently doing across the organisation, one of the major components is whether or not where and when we may need to double team. You know, a significant amount of our work is done with staff members on their own. You know, apart from when it's a high hazard, which is in and around water, but getting to our jobs is high hazard. We're on the road, and the buddy system that we operate, you know, each staff member knows has another person who knows where they are. But that doesn't stop you having an accident, and you know, I mean, we're talking about check-ins at sort of lunchtime and at the end of the day. So if you have an accident, sort of within
half an hour of getting to the work site, you can be there for a long time. So staff are equipped with e-perfs, so if you're conscious enough to be able to press the button or use the phone, you're okay. But if you're not, in the case of that accident in Wellington, we are exposed. But again, matching that financial implication of double teaming is something that you know, I think in the long term plan this council needs to consider.
Councillor Kenton.
Just very briefly, it's something I meant to mention before, and I don't want to get into the detail too much, but there was something that jumped out at me, and it was about driving. And it says here, monitoring fatigue and pulling off the road and rest if required. The last person who can monitor their fatigue levels is the driver that goes to sleep.
Yeah.
Right? So what's really important, I think, is that whoever's thinking through these things has a look at that and says, well, maybe we need to tell people to take an obligatory break. So that if you've been driving for an hour and a half, I don't know what the rules are, somebody else will have a better understanding of that. If you've been driving for this long, you've got to stop. Right? Now, if they don't stop, well, that's another issue. But the thing about that is that it's virtually impossible for somebody to monitor their own condition. As somebody who has fallen asleep, and not feeling for a moment tired, and been in an accident as a result of that, I had a little bit of experience with that. So what it boils down to is that actually putting something in place that means you don't have to rely quite so much on deciding how you feel. And that might be a principle that goes well beyond just the driving thing. Sorry about getting into the detail.
No. Okay. I think
happy to move that the report's received.
Thank you.
I don't think there's actually a recommendation there.
Yes, if you so moved by Councillor Woodhead, seconder. Do we have it?
Yep.
Thank you, Councillor Robertson. All in favour?
Aye.
Aye.
Against? Carried. Okay, if we could then move to the paper two, which is legislative compliance. Mr. Donnelly.
Meeting we have an annual update just on the so this paper has given us the key legislative changes that are impacting our business, and just an update on some other acts where we've had external audits and the like performed. So again, you know, happy to answer any questions on that.
I wonder probably to Mr. Donnelly and Mr. Bodick, if I might add, certainly from my experience, I may have mentioned this earlier in the earlier training on this legislative compliance. I think a useful process for me and other organisations has been to actually get a full list of the legislation that affects whatever we do as an organisation, and then ensure that you get that goes out to the individual managers and directors, and get positive compliance from them, that to the best of their knowledge they're complying. And that, to me, it is a useful exercise in people actually thinking about that each piece of legislation, when they have to sign a bit of paper to say that they, as far as they're aware, they've complied, would be useful. Is that an option, do you think, that you could institute?
For those that were on board in this last training, we did look at some software to do exactly that, called Comply With, and
yep.
we went down the route of investigating and seeing how that would fit, and that would do exactly what you're saying, and looked it would be very useful. And getting into it, there was quite some staff time involved in it, and it was going to prove it's actually quite an expensive piece of software as well. So before we sort of went down any further with that, we were looking at alternatives of whether we could fulfil that same sort of what you were sort of suggesting around some sort of matrix checklist with, you know, the various managers and directors signing off, just via some sort of spreadsheet or
yeah.
something developed internally that might be a bit less costly. So it's definitely on our radar, but it hasn't been developed any further.
Okay. Any other comments? Councilor?
Yeah, that was exactly what I was thinking as well. The report at the moment is kind of piecemeal. Yep. It's useful in respect to the few things that it touches on, but absolutely agree that we need a more comprehensive look at whether we're meeting our legal obligations, I guess. And I think what you described then, Nick's really useful. I think what are the key direct obligations on us, and are we meeting them? There's a whole lot more than just perhaps what we're seeing at the moment. Like, are we reviewing our plans every 5 years? Are we monitoring the state of them? Whatever, all our obligations in whatever statute, there's heaps of them, but we need a more comprehensive look. Exactly.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Okay, do we have a mover that the report be received, please? Councillor Robertson, yep. Seconder. Councillor Brown, all in favour?
Aye.
Against? Carried. The next item is section 17A, reviews. Mr. Donnelly.
So this is an update on section 17A, reviews. As most people will be aware, this came out of changes to the Local Government Act, so this is a requirement under this section to undertake reviews to look at current arrangements and potential better ways to deliver the services that we do, and that can cover governance, funding and delivery of those infrastructure and services. So what we've got here in this paper is just outlining where we're at in relation to, we have a project underway with the TAs, and that's looking at identifying and then the areas that we can undertake these reviews together, and then developing a program for actually doing those reviews. As we've said previously, the first review that we actually kicked off fairly quickly under this was the Emergency Management Otago review, and we've already seen where the result of that is, the changes that have been undertaken there, and this just outlines the progress that that group has got to date, and where we're going and what the work programme is going forward.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question? Why is this item on the agenda? I don't understand the purpose of order and risk. I mean, so I don't have explained to me. This is my first meeting. Seven order and risk committees report. And this is a report. You know, I don't see any risk here. I don't see any auditing. This is a report that surely should be going through the normal committee chair of the council. And I don't know why it's on this agenda. So could you explain it to me? Because I haven't yet seen a definition of what order and risk is and how this would fit that definition.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's wide and as it is long sometimes in terms of terms of risk. I guess it's a legislative requirement, and there are, I guess, implications in respect to auditing in relation to meeting those legislative requirements, and I guess it falls within that. But I guess it could go to the Finance Committee equally, but this committee, information goes into the Finance and the Finance Committee anyway, Mr. Don.
Yeah, I thought cost effectiveness was one of the specific responsibilities of the Audit and Risk Committee, which is why the Section 17A's, which is all around cost effectiveness, that's why it was felt that it falled under the terms and the responsibilities of Audit and Risk.
I would have thought cost effectiveness belonged to the Finance Committee, number one. Number two, this is an Audit and Risk Committee. So in other words, what risks are the Otago Regional Council facing across a range of areas, from fiscal to policy to political? And then you audit the financial accounts and programs to make sure that they're working and what risk they may throw up. So there's so much missing from this audit agenda that I want to talk about. But then there's this here, and I'm sort of struggling, where's the risk? This is just an update of what the mayoral forums do.
Yep, but there's auditing implications. Councillor Kempton.
Well, yeah, look, as far as I'm concerned, around the points that Councillor Dawes has made, This isn't about our cost effectiveness, this is about the cost effectiveness of delivering local government services across, if you like, the region and all of the local government institutions within that region. It is entirely consistent with what we have in the previous report, which is simply they are other pieces of legislation that, and this is a very special piece of legislation, there are other pieces of legislation upon which our auditors will rule us up on. And it seems to me that it's entirely appropriate for it to be here, and it would be one of the line items in the full summary that I think we generally agree we'd like to see. So if it's a line item in there, it's part of this deal. I had a couple of things I just wanted to...
If I could just interrupt, Councillor, and I think related to that part of your comments, I think the paper is really just taking it to the point where it sets the process underway to do the reviews, Mr. Donnelly, as I understand it. So it's process driven, and then there will have to be decisions on which areas the actual review takes place. That's the point of the report, isn't it?
Yeah, the process. The report is an update on where the process is at today.
So my apologies for interrupting.
Oh, no problem at all. I usually just carry on while I'm going.
Yep. Fair enough.
But anyway, look, I was very pleased to see that there's a robust methodology around carrying out these reviews, and I was very business case and it was probably all over the place, like royalty. So it's good. I had a question about the Mayoral Forum Fund, the basis for that. I didn't understand that entirely. Do we tip into that, do we?
Yes.
We do. Okay, so there's a sub, essentially, a subscription that comes out of that.
Yes. Speaking, Mr. Chairman. Yes, if some of them aren't ours, so we don't contribute, but there is a formula as to how much we contribute. Yes.
Yeah. So there's no subscription.
Yeah.
It's on a project-by-project
basis. Okay, that's fine. The land transport roading activities, presumably, are we talking about planning or operations? Just one other one here. Done.
Is that an offer?
Presumably this is around operate. Well, yeah, it's possible. Around the likes of combining...
It's about operations, it's about roading.
Okay. Yeah. The other question I had was ORC has no role in solid waste. We do have a role in solid waste. We have a very old waste plan that's still current. And so what happens around waste and how it happens and the controls around waste are in our plan. Okay, if they want to go away and dig holes and wherever it is or cart their waste somewhere else, it's actually got to be compliant with our plan, the manner in which they do that. On that basis, do we have some role in solid waste? Given that if all of the TLAs are attempting to pull together some gee whiz proposition around waste, in the early stages of that investigation, would we not want to have the opportunity to provide some oversight role with respect to our waste plan? Which I know is old, but I haven't still.
Really? I think we're trying to, whatever you do, a waste plan when you don't have one.
Well, we do have one.
So this is around the, I think you've touched on the point at the moment, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
From a planning perspective, whether the districts operate their own landfills or there's a joined up at Otago one,
sure.
Imagine, they will need to comply with the regional or national rules, policies, legislation. So my understanding from the debate at the Mayoral Forum, Mr. Bodeker, was this was around the operation of landfills, the solid waste, the collection of the rubbish and the operation of landfills, not the planning side of it. Correct.
No, yeah. But it was just that I was thinking of whether our role in waste was to just keep them watching brief on their thinking and give them some confidence or otherwise around any tracks they might think of going down.
Yeah, look, I'm sure that would come back the other way immediately if there was some different proposition around the operation of solid waste over time, which it could very well be. And it's a big ticket item.
I mean, the other condition, Councillor, from that is who do I send? I mean, I just haven't got that spare resource to have somebody engaged in that activity. And I'm not trying to be churlish about this. It's a real consideration. So the closest I would get would be someone who has got interest in contaminated sites, one of the EMO team. But to try and find somebody to put some time into something like this when our interest is perhaps peripheral or cursory, I just haven't got that resource.
No, I think probably taking a bigger bite than I had in mind. I felt that there just needed to be a connection between our waste plan and what they were thinking about in their minds.
Yeah.
So that if something popped up, they knew that there was somebody to talk to, rather than us rolling sleeves up and getting down and dirty in their waste activity.
What we can do is we can make sure that they are aware of the waste plan and its conditions, and that's probably appropriate.
Okay, Councillor Woodhead.
So there's a point there where these recommendations have been initially scoped at the Mural Forum. Staff have gone away from around the region and done those initial high-level investigations. This is the conclusions that have been reached. The Mural Forum has accepted those and now, as pointed out in paragraph 2 on page 17, it's now up to each council to confirm or decline to participate in the regional reviews. And so that'll flow from this process to finance and court, I'd imagine, and on to council as well. I just wanted to make sure everybody was understood that.
Okay, any other comments? Other than getting somebody now then to move that the report be noted, and I think the next milestones are on page 18 just before the recommendation there. So a mover, Councillor Kempton, seconded by Councillor Woodhead. All in favour?
Aye.
Aye. Against? Carried. Okay, next one is the financial report for to the end of January 2017, 7 months, Mr. Donnelly.
So this seven-month report. On the P&L there, you'll note we do have an underspend in our expenses. Part of that 880 underspend in the operating expenses is actually the we did have some of the building work was put into the budget as operating expenses when we're reviewing that, because it really should be capital and so not shown there. So we will be reviewing that. But then if you go down to page 26, has the actual project spend. There's an overspend. A total underspend, of 433 in the actual projects, and that is a mix of operating and capital expenditure. And we've noted the main reasons for that. There is still some overspends mixed in that, which most people are aware of around emergency management and Harbour Master in particular.
So the two there are the Harbour Master, the two overspends and EMO. I was just interested in the Harbour Master, how that is evolving, because I guess in a risk sense that to me seems should be high on the agenda, Mr. Bodeker, and interested to know where you are at in respect to that function.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We advertised and were in a position of offering a position to a successful candidate. He was a senior officer in the Navy. He was involved in the civil defence activity at Kaikoura and was lured back to active service. So we lost him. He was not a second. So we are in the process, as we speak, of we waited a period and then we're advertising again.
Yeah.
The people that are operating the Harbour Master are doing a superb job. We have never been as well covered as we are at the moment. And it's not just waiting for something to happen. They are active in signage in and around the Dunedin, the Otago Harbour, not just the shipping lanes, but also recreation. They've got signage at the Tyree Mouth. So it's not just a they're there ready, they are very, very active. So port and harbour safety code is a significant piece of work that we're doing. We have to do in conjunction with Maritime New Zealand. They've been active in that, and we're certainly involved in the oil spill or the fishing boat grounding in Oamaru Harbour 3 or 4 weekends ago. So, and yes, it's costing us more than we had budgeted, but as I said, we have never been as well covered as we are with these two.
Good. Any other comments?
I did just say Brown. I was talking to an activist around the harbour just recently, and she was full of praise for our work we've been doing around here. Lots of things have been done that have been waiting for a long time to get done, so she was just so full of praise.
At the Dunedin Harbour.
Mm.
Yep.
Just one other, if I might add, Mr. Bodeker, just around emergency management, it is pleasing to see the new arrangements underway. I know they were, Mr. Bowley, modelled somewhat on Wellington, which I was involved in. I guess, you know, they improve all the time, but your view would be significant improvement on where we were before.
I mean, we've actually got we've got the local people that are certainly enthused. And the ability of the current manager to engage with emergency services and other formal groups. So for example, he was involved in, and it might be 2 days, but certainly yesterday in Alexandra, looking at emergency response with those emergency response teams and our local people. So, you know, getting groups of people together involved in ambulance, fire, New Zealand Defence, if it's appropriate, you know, search and rescue, those sorts of people in the regions or in the district. So, really, really happy. I mean, the vision that we've got is that we'll have a standing army of 200 trained local government staff over the next few years. That's the discussion that we're about to have around LTP time, because there'll be a big cost in that if we're going to release staff to keep their training up and to have regular meetings. So that's the vision we've got for emergency management at Otago. And a very good relationship with Southland. We know that when we have to evacuate Queenstown, if we're blocked to the north, they'll have to go out through Frankton and they'll be in Southland. So we've got a good working relationship with the Southland people as well.
So no doubt, given the recent experiences in Christchurch now, just recently in Wellington, these people are liaising with those, because I do know, notwithstanding the model that's in place in Wellington now, there are certainly some holes in that process this time around, particularly in the communications area. I guess that's part of the role.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean that's a difficult one because. I know with the youngest member of my family, she hasn't ever heard of national radio, let alone got any idea where to find it, and national radio is still the single central government delivery agent for messaging. So getting Twitter and emails and Facebook up and running is something that we're focusing on to engage. So, yeah, we're well aware of it, but I think what we saw in Christchurch again was just that lack of understanding between various agencies around the fires. In particular, was a lack of understanding in various agencies as to whose responsibility it was. And you know, we had rural fire intersecting with civil defence and so on. So, I mean, I think our manager is of a personality that. That people know that what his role is, and I'm confident that when it's our turn, we'll be in a good place.
Councillor Kempton.
Just in terms of this report, the financial report, I don't think there's any surprises for me in there in terms of the direction in which things are moving or have been moving. But what I wonder about is, when I do look at a report of, budget, whether it be revenue or cost, budget versus our budget to date and what we've spent to date, when you see something, and we have got some things here that are, you know, as much as 100% out. I mean, fortunately, they don't, you know, they don't add up to a lot, but they're there. If we were able to have alongside that our forecast for the end of the year, because what that means is I can look at that and say, oh, it looks like it's been accepted that it's going to cost what it's going to cost for one item. On the other hand, you might actually see the overspend tail off, which means either it's a timing issue or we've actually put a tourniquet on it. And so there's some messages come out of that. And the other thing is our managers who are coming up with these numbers or feeding the information through to your staff, Nick, actually have to think about whether it's manageable or not manageable, and what their response, you know, to think about their response to a, what might be an unfavourable situation now is when they say, I think we can get here at the end of the year. Now, I imagine that most of the time that's going to be, I mean, some of the time that'll be close to intuitive, and most of the time it will not be with any great accuracy, but the trend, to my mind, ought to be there, that either we can stitch the flow or we can't, or it might be a timing issue. And just with that forecast, we know where the end of the year on this tells a lot more than what we've got there. And I wonder if that might be possible. I know that again, people are forecasters playing hard. Oh, but I just don't know. Well, you've got a better idea than anyone else.
Well, I think, Councillor, that's a really good suggestion. I would 100% agree with that. And before I come to Mr. Donnelly to respond to that, I mean, I think the other thing in there, when you do see variances, you worry about whether the money, even if it's underspent, is whether the job's been done.
Yes.
And it's not only the financial result, it's the delivery. And I understand that your six-monthly review, you know, things were pretty much expected still to be completed by the year end. And I think last year when we went through that, things were pretty close to the mark, but I guess the two are in tandem. The financials are the financials, and I agree we need the forecasted numbers there, but also the delivery of the actual work, if you like. Well, nothing worse than spending the money and nothing gets
done. I've been reasonably satisfied with the traffic lights and the explanations that come through to council, because they flesh the story out.
Right.
But just in terms of being able to see that forecast, even in, you know, at the times that those reports are presented, would be really useful. But I know that it's a little bit of work on the part of the managers, but it does also suggest that they're thinking about the last half of the year.
And you probably need only to do it every quarter rather than every month.
And that's what we actually do with the 4 and 8 month reviews. So we're not doing it quarterly, we do the 4, 8 and 12.
Right.
So the 4 and 8, we do the forecast and we have the traffic light forecast, and we get the estimates of then what that means for the numbers. So when we're looking at this is the, you know, the monthly year-to-date financial update, so we don't go into that level of detail.
I have to say, I've actually seen forecasts to year end in the traffic light report. Am I wrong? Are they there?
I'd have to go back and look at the 4 month one. I know last year certainly when we did the 8 month one, which is the next report that'll go, we definitely had forecasts going through in that.
The end of year budget's there in those ones, isn't it?
Yeah, the end of year budget, but we also
forecast action.
Yeah.
Well, look, if that's happening, I'll apologise and I'll go back. I'll look more closely. But it was just when I looked at this, I thought, oh, there's just something missing.
Yeah, so I think you're right, and I'm pretty sure I'd raised it in the past anyway. So, but being a little bit out of this cycle, I think we're going to see it at the 8 month anyway, Councillor.
Oh, that's good. Thanks.
Okay, any other?
Yes.
Councillor Woodhead.
Page 25, just a couple of wee details, one clarification and one wondering what. Rates, revenue and receivables, and outstanding are 1.308 million, and I thought that was a little bit high. Is this direct debits in there too, Mr. Donnelly? So we do have a direct debit, ability for people to direct debit, and some of our targeted rate payers who have got larger sums do utilise it. Are they sitting there as outstanding, or is that true outstanding?
I'd have to check. I actually think that that's the true outstanding, and it's actually not that high.
Oh, is it?
Because this is total rates.
Yes.
Remember, it's not just general rates, it's general
yep.
targeted.
Yes.
So our rates collection, I believe I did a report to Finance and Corp in the last meeting, and it was our outstandings that weren't actually paid on time
yep.
in the usual
were overdue.
Yeah, that were overdue was in line with
yep.
previous years. That number off the top of my head is consistent with what I was reporting
Thanks.
Then.
Right.
So
sorry,
yeah, there's
so roughly small in percentage terms.
Yep.
Just forget the exact.
Yeah. Well, I just thought 1.3 out of 8
yeah.
or whatever was a reasonable number for us at this stage.
I think
June and October.
Yeah, I think from but most people will pay in October,
yep.
and then we have then we'll pursue them over the remainder of the year. I think from memory we have about 84-85% pay
yes.
Basic pay in October,
yes.
and then we pursue the rest. And the big thing is once we sort of get a bit more of a kick in when we issue the penalties, some will pay. But then we have to go through the process, and it takes a few months. The next big sort of step when we'll get some of those catch up is when we've identified the ones that we'll push on to debt collection, and then we get a bit more traction on that. But overall, 80, that mid 80% is paying on time.
Yep. Yes. Yep.
I think you've got the ultimate sanction as well, haven't you?
Yes.
The property.
Attach it to the land.
Yes.
Yeah.
Any other?
Just another wee point of clarification here, sorry, on page 27 on that. The minimum flow is the last paragraph right down the bottom of page 27. And increase in monitoring requirements. So the monitoring requirements attached to the minimum flow process are actually end up being coded or costed against policy.
Well, they'll be costed against that project.
Yes,
they might not be costed against.
Yeah,
in any project, you can have,
yep.
Multiple directorates involved, but this is the overall project, so it's not just the policy
right.
stuff.
That's cool. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Sorry, we're discussing the financial accounts.
Yep.
Yes, can I ask how this committee actually monitors the contracts that it lets? So, for example, you've given over $500,000 to the Manuhira Care Irrigation Company. It's a contract, you just give them money. How do you monitor that money is spent effectively, and how does it report back to this committee?
Peter?
Yep, well, that money is a grant, and the grant is for certain work that they do. So it's not a contract in the sense of a formal contractual arrangement. So they make an application. The application is covered by a description of the work they're doing, and then that money is funded. So what happens is that I, as the OIC representative, sit on a number of their committees, and from time to time we will ask, in this case, the independent chair and or project manager to report to council. And I had a meeting with the chair and the deputy chair this morning, and that was an agenda item, and we will have the Manuhira Care Irrigation Chair reporting to council at a workshop.
Well, it shouldn't go to a workshop, shouldn't it be coming here? I mean, it's a huge sum of money that you've expended in one project, which essentially is a public good being delivered for private interest. Which is
incredible.
But you've made that decision, so that's great. But if you go, it's been happening for how long now? 3 years? 4 years? Is that right?
Yes,
yeah.
About that time, yeah.
Are you aware of this, Chair?
Oh, yes. And
No, this Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I'm not necessarily avoiding the question, but my understanding would be there would be hundreds, if not thousands, of contracts that this organisation has, and there will be there will be processes involved in monitoring the performance of every one of those contracts through various reporting lines through the management of the organisation. I don't think it's the role of this committee to review all the contracts in the organisation. You rely on the management to ensure that those contracts are being completed within the contract amount, and any variances are then reported. But that's my assessment of what would occur, Mr. Bodeker.
I mean, we have contracts with far greater amounts of money than that. Managed care has been over a number of years. We do lots of activities which you could say is public money for private benefit. But that's the decision of council. The criteria under which those sorts of grants are made is very clear, and I adhere to it.
I've raised that issue specifically because, Mr. Benham, I'm afraid your reply isn't very satisfactory. You're an audit committee. Now, for you to say, as chairman of the audit and risk committee, we're going to rely on staff. Our responsibility is to make sure that we monitor contracts independently of staff to make sure that we can assure the Auditor General, and that was the purpose of the Audit and Risk Committee being established, was to make sure that the council monies that are expended can be independently verified or can be monitored on occasion to make sure that they've been spent in an appropriate way.
And there is an audit process that I would understand. I understand through the audit that Deloitte, who are the auditors of the organisation, would pick a bunch of contracts and would look at that, I understand.
But why wouldn't we be doing that if we're the Audit Risk Committee?
Well, I don't think that's the role of this committee. Councillor Robertson?
Oh, I was just first of all going to pick up on the point that we're talking about contracts and these are grants, slightly different.
Yeah, sure.
But I think you've probably hit on a point, which is that with our grants, because we've got a number of them now, we've been growing them, types of grants that we extend to the public, that we need a clear policy as well as the criteria to which a grant will be awarded as to how it would be monitored as well in terms of its success, I suppose.
Yep.
And it's probably not a requirement to be particularly, I don't know, detailed with that, but we do need to at least have a policy on what we're expecting people to provide to us in terms of information about what they have been spending that money on and whether they've achieved it.
Councillor Woodhead.
So just to flesh that out a little more, the Manuhiri is just one example, and we are a co-funder. Often the organisations using our grant money leverage a lot of Crown Irrigation Fund or whatever the other is, and some local community fund as well. That, Mr. Bodeker, the application that you receive makes that clear, and it will stipulate very clearly the block of work to be done. So it's not, in this case, 500,000 in one chunk.
No.
There's been portions over a number of years to do different stages of pre-feasibility or a full feasibility study, etc. When that block of work is completed, you receive that output. So it certainly is accountabilities there, and there's full visibility on that work.
Well, you were referring to grants, Councillor, not contracts, because I was thinking.
Sorry, I used the word loosely. It was grants, that's right.
Okay.
And my concern is, in that particular case, it's an incredibly loose arrangement. I want to know how many others there are like that in this organisation. And I'm expecting, as on the Board of Risk, and these are my expectations if they're not yours, but they're certainly mine sitting here, that we have the opportunity to monitor those grants as they go through. It's no good looking at it at the end. You know, the money's gone then. We should be able to monitor the effectiveness during and making sure that it is still meeting the purposes for which it was originally established, and I take the Gretchen's point to that conclusion.
It's just for my, what are we talking about in terms of numbers of grants that might be in a year? Because taking your point, I accept that. I mean, it probably, and Councillor Robertson's point, just thinking of the work involved, but it probably wouldn't be that much to just list them all and report against them if there's, what, half a dozen of them, or is there more?
Yeah, well, there's two funds. There's the irrigation fund, which funds pre-feasibility and feasibility studies for irrigation schemes, which Manahara Care is currently a recipient of. The Strathtyre Irrigation Group is a second one, and management just considered a request from the Chisholm Park Golf Club to use DCC wastewater under an irrigation group, considered it on Monday. So that will be three. And then there's the Environmental Enhancement Fund. Council have given the Chief Executive delegation for grant for requests under $50,000. And Nick, we've got probably 10 of those that we've funded over the last 18 months or so. You know, they range probably from about $10,000 under, but they're normally well under that. We did three the other day at EMT, and they were around the $4,000 mark from memory, and they were for scrub cutters and gloves and chainsaw oil, and you know, it's small stuff for community groups to go out and do some good work. The big one, which was the Halo project from Orokanui, public working on their own properties to get rid of pests, because that was over $50,000, it came to full council, and the council approved it. And that has a reporting process, a very stringent reporting process, which our staff will go and report the outcomes. So I'm happy to report. I know it's a full answer, but...
So you're happy to provide a report on... grants.
Well, both of those two funds, either Mr. Bodick is covering in his CE report, because if he's exercised delegation, he notes it in there. But we're also in our 4 and 8 month reporting, those two projects are noted in there. The Bulk Rural Water Fund is a separate project in its own right. So the summary of what's spent is covered off in there.
No, you're only talking about the money. We're talking about the effectiveness. Or the order of the grants that are made.
Councillor Robertson?
Yeah, that was the point that I was going to make. It's about how do we know that the money has actually been used wisely, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah, sorry,
have
I was,
we got a policy
I
on
was
that?
Talking about the actual spending of the money. Yep.
Councillor Kemp.
Look, I think one thing that's quite important is that the Audit and Risk Committee actually deals with audit and risk. And of course, we have a strong relationship with the external auditors, and we have to deal with risk. And to my mind, what we do here is we actually establish as an audit and risk committee that there must be certain gateways and milestones associated with grants. And that will be in terms of you don't establish a grant unless you've got a reporting procedure, and that reporting procedure has to take place. It's been approved by council, it goes back to council. If it's been approved by staff, it goes back to staff. It seems to me that if in fact that trail hasn't been followed, our external auditors are going to pick that up. And so to my mind, we say here are the kind of the minimum requirements around grants, and then as long as we are certain that there is a process that will actually check that, and the external auditors will certainly check that if it exists, job done in my view. I don't think that we necessarily have to do a line by line thing around grants. I mean, others may differ, but I think that that's what we say.
So, summing it up, if I could, given the comment around grants, and it seems as though it's in different places, but maybe it could be drawn together in here in terms of both the list of the grants, where what's been granted, and a summary of delivery performance, councillor.
Okay.
And yeah, I guess that's not like, you know, as Councillor Kempton said, it's not a line by line with them all. It's more that is there a policy that's tracking that they're actually done.
Is that what this committee, because that's not what Councillor is asking.
I'm quite specific about what I want.
Okay.
But it's not contrary to what you're asking for, Richard. That what I'm saying is that we are giving out these grants. They've been here 4 months, but your audit and risk, there's a huge sum of money gone into ManuHeritCare, into a private concern. I've tracked back over papers. I haven't seen any mechanism by which this council has verified that that money is being spent A, appropriately, but B, that it's being spent effectively, and that it is, I would have thought after you'd spent that much money, you'd do that before you get your next grant out. Now, it might have satisfied the chief executive, that's fair enough, but it hasn't satisfied me. And I'm sitting on the audit risk committee, and this is an audit risk committee that's set up expressly, read Councillor Woodhead's public comments on this, set up expressly to do that, to make sure that we are getting and effectively monitoring the money that we are spending on behalf of the council.
Okay. So I think the summation of that, Councillor Woodhead, are you? I think in terms of the grants, given the comments of Councillor Lawless, Councillor Robertson and Councillor Kempton, that it seems to me that it wouldn't be asking too much, at least, to report to this committee in terms of grants, expenditure and some assessment of effectiveness. What sort of regularity, Mr. Chief Executive, would you suggest? Would that be quarterly?
I'm suggesting, quarterly or 6 monthly. We require for grants over $50,000 in the Environmental Enhancement Fund a six monthly report, and for grants under $50,000 a 12-month report. So I can report as often as you want. Some of them will be active. I can put the active grants and when they're due reporting date, and that will show you the magnitude of them and where we're up to in the reporting cycle.
Because I'm assuming that they are budgeted anyway, and they're just implementing the budget. But I think your point, Councillor Laws, is more around the effectiveness of the spend.
Exactly.
And that's going to be, no doubt, a judgment call, but I'm sure that can be produced. So my suggestion would be perhaps up to 6 months and then annually. Would you be happy with that, Councillor Laws?
Well, I'd like to see one now. So I'd like to see where we are with the grants now, so that the next Audit and Risk Committee gets that. I don't think we should be waiting 6 months.
Well, it would be June. But anyway, are you happy with that sort of reporting, Councillor Robertson?
Yeah, I don't have any problems with
that. Okay. Councillor Brown.
I think it should be 6 months, but at the end of the day, this is not a function of this committee control to environmental aims. It's really a management responsibility, but it would be good to have a summation of the grants we are handing out occasionally and a comment about the effectiveness of the way they've been used, because we give money at Walden Pines, we give it out to others. So, you know, it's things like that.
Okay, I think that's enough on that issue, and I think it's been noted, and thank you for raising it, Councillor Laws. And I think we can now move to the noting of the financial report 31 January. Do I have a mover? Councillor Woodhead seconded. Councillor Robertson, all in favour?
Aye.
Aye. Against? Carried. Okay, now let's move to, I think it's now the public excluded.
Can we deal with those issues now that I raised before him?
Sure. Now, do you want to Councillor?
Well, it really goes to the definition of what order and risks are going to do. I don't think we should be here as a rubber stamping machine for reports that come here, and I think that defeats the purpose. There are things missing from today's audit and risk that I would expect to see on any ordinary audit and risk agenda. For example, legal issues and legal risks. How many court cases or potential legal actions is the regional council either
A, involved in, B, likely to be involved in or potentially subject to. And that would normally come to a committee like this. So legal risk that the council faces. I'm aware of one, for example, where we're apparently in mediation with various landowners to do with the Lindis, trying to avert a environment court case. But that's a clear risk to the organisation, if that fails. I'm also interested in personal grievances. So how do you, if there are staff personal grievances that have a legal implication, they should be coming to audit the risk, it seems to me, as well.
Could I just interrupt, Councillor? Sorry, I don't want to stop you midstream, but I just want Mr. Donnelly to just explain the risk framework that the council has, because I think there's a number, you know, there's a number of risks clearly in the organisation, and there is and needs to be a process whereby those risks arrive at the audit and risk committee. If he could just explain that process and the framework and where it is at now and which where the next stage of that is in relation to getting it to this committee.
Yeah, before I do that, can I just clarify? So, because the risk item was covered in my director's report,
yep.
Which is part of the in-committee agenda.
Yep.
I think Council of Laws is sort of raising some other issues, so I'm not 100% sure.
No,
where
not,
I think we're just talking generally on
I
risk,
just,
so
yeah.
I think we can cover that
yeah.
in this
yeah.
part
so,
of the meeting.
So are we discussing the risk item?
We're not discussing a particular risk item, a specific one, like, for example, the I'll just use an example. We're talking about the generalised concept that you would report these, because I've looked at the exclusion only. It comes to that in a second. Clause is here. But there's nothing that really deals in a separate section with legal risk. So what court cases we are, as I explained to you, likely to be involved in going to that potential action, things like that. And I didn't see anything there about personal grievances. Did you see anything? So either are none, which is fine, but you know, those sorts of actions when there might be staff involvement and things like that, that have the element or the potential to spill out into the front pages and things like that.
Well, the risk item that's in that's in my director's report, which is in, you know, was covered in the committee, so is, what that's covering is where we're at with our risk management strategy and framework and we have an update on where we've got to with our risk reporting. So that's quite different than what you're talking about of specific risks. So that's why I'm not sure whether we're talking about the same things and whether
well,
we want to...
I think that tied up in terms of the process of dealing with risk in the organisation.
No, I think the next report is mostly about financial risk around investments from memories, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, well, that's a different item that's covered in my director's report.
Yeah.
The risks, what you're wanting to discuss is and basically is items that aren't on the agenda. You know, that what's
that's
missing
what
off the agenda,
you
which
put on the agenda next time. That's
yeah, which is sort of a different discussion item than even the risk item, because I get the impression that although you mentioned a couple of risk elements, there might be other things that you wanted to discuss.
Yep.
And I'm not too sure where that fits into the agenda.
Yep. And I guess what I'm saying is that. I expected that to be covered off somewhere. Like, for example, I know the council's facing legal risks in certain areas. But where do you report those? And the whole idea is that it's the old, you know, issue about potential threats to the organisation. And they can be legal, they can be environmental, they can be policy, political, etc. And this is a classic.
Mm.
And I'm just saying, where would that go? Because it isn't a separate item here. But I would expect there to be one.
Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, look, I think we've got to be really careful about this, because when we're talking about the Lindis, we are neither proponents nor respondents. That is simply an RMA process in which we have a part to play. We go to the Environment Court, that's just simply the end of that process. That is not, in my view, a legal risk to this organisation at all. It's simply part of a process that hasn't finished yet. And it hasn't, as I say, we are neither proponents nor respondents in that. And when we've got to be real careful when we're starting to talk about staff matters, for instance, and when we're starting to talk about regulatory matters, because they're and exactly where the line's drawn, I'm not expert enough to know. But I certainly understand that with respect to governance and with respect to management, and particularly in the regulatory area, there's some very, very strong, good practice protocols that say governance keeps its nose out. So we've got to be real careful to then be able to say, well, what's left and how material is that?
I think when we get Councillor Laws, when we get to the item in Mr Donnelly's report on risk, because I've talked to him about it, and other organisations are involved in dealing with risk, fundamentally, once the framework's in place, which it is, and the strategy's in place, then there is a list from top to bottom in the organisation of every risk that there is, and then there is some assessment around it's the extent of it that narrows it down to top 10 or top 20, which then are covered by this committee. That's work in progress, as I understand it, and that would then, I would think, would pretty much cover the areas that you're concerned about, because that's every risk that they've identified in the organisation, which is within that framework, and that work hasn't been completed as yet, Mr Donald.
No, that's right. That's what the risk update on risk reporting in my director's report was about. We've done the framework, identified how that's going to be put together. The bit that we've got to do is work through the risks in a series of workshops with staff to assess those and look at the likelihood and consequence, and then the mitigating actions we've got in place to get the residual risk. So a number of things will come out of that, and that's what that item was about.
Right.
I think what Councillor Laws is alluding to specific now is specific reporting on an ongoing basis to this committee on certain legal, or staff like PGs or whatever. Now, which is slightly is different again.
Councillor Woodard.
So the updates on the policy matters, such as Lindis appeals to plan changes, appeals to consents, complaints about the costs of consent process and the likes come through the normal committee reports. Now the updates are focused on process mostly, and for example Lindis, I'm pretty sure it was in the last policy committee, which talked about the BEAT arbitration. There was an agreement to do some RPS, agreement to do some monitoring this summer, and it's been a wet summer and etc. So there's those updates from those specifics sitting in either policy or regulatory committees.
Right, but risk committee,
exactly,
though, will look at a summary of the highest risks,
yes,
once this process is completed.
Well, I'm not surprised that I didn't get it, because it's only one paragraph that Nick's written. Is that right, Nick? And it's about the risk management strategy. So it doesn't include the things that I've canvassed as part of it. So, that's why I'm raising it now.
Yep, no, well,
I will note, in looking at that, the last sentence that I put there was that for the benefit of the new councillors, is I'd actually said that the risk management framework, which had been adopted by at the previous Audit and Risk Committee, I said it was attached, and looking at it, I didn't attach it.
No,
so I've made a mistake there. And I think if I'd attached it and you'd had a read through that, potentially it would answer. At least it would give you the framework for where we're at, and it has the list of the sort of risks that will then be then be attached. So
well, before I leave this building today, do you think I can get a copy?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, could we then just now address the resolutions then to go into public excluded? And could I just, before we put that motion, just get Mr. Donnelly to explain the reasons, because I understand Council Laws has some issues with the moving of some or all of these items into PE.
So we've got three items. So item 5 is the managed fund report. That's proposed to be in committee essentially due to commercial sensitivity. Section 7.2H is essentially what that section is about. The audit management letter, which is item 6, is proposed for in committee, as that is a confidential document that Deloitte provide to us. And then item 7 on my director's report, although we have just discussed the risk item on there. The key ones in there is the BNZ controls report and the SIPO document, both of which are there to allow us to carry on our business, and there's the commercial sensitivity element associated with both of those.
Mr. Chairman.
Councillor Orr.
The basic principle that governs moving into committee is the Local Government Official Information Meetings Act of 1987. And its overriding principle is, and I quote, the principle that the information shall be made available unless there is good reason for withholding it. And then there are some exclusions, but the general principle is that you let information go. I've never seen these three items except where there are, and so generally it's two principles that govern this. Only two examples. It's one where there is safety or there is potential damage to an individual, usually a staff member, but it could be somebody else as well. And the second is where the commercial confidentiality exists to a potential damage to a commercial entity as a consequence of that information being made public. In neither of those cases does this apply. So, for example, in the managed fund report, this is, in any other council, and certainly with government as well, for example, the government superannuation funds, this is freely available as information. It is investments about where we have our investments and where BNZ are putting them. And there is nothing confidential about that at all. There is no damage to any commercial entity as a consequence of the information being made public. It also doesn't compromise any individual. It is a factual recount of where the money is that the ratepayer of Otago has paid for, where it is invested, and how much it made or didn't make last year. That's it. How on earth is that commercially sensitive? On the second issue of the audit management letter, same. My last council, you got audit management councils, you put them on the table, they were freely discussed, you existed on the principle of in actual fact, open information, and most councils, if not all of them, do. And the idea again is so that you can have a free and frank discussion of these particular issues. You've got nothing to hide. If there's some sort of audit issue, again, there are only two provisions to that. If there's damage to the privacy of a particular individual or a particular reputation, or there is somebody who is going to be commercially compromised by the release of that information. Again, it doesn't happen in item 2. And I'd argue also in Mr. Donnelly's report, same. Now, in Mr. Donnelly, it's really interesting that there's a case coming, if we put these matters into committee, where there's a bit of a scrap between Deloitte and BNZ over providing some form of surety. Now, frankly, given that it's our money, these are advices that it's here, it's not compromising them at all. There are no individuals compromised by giving us the advice. So it's not going to stop the free flow of information. The worst part of this is, and this is the worst part, that all this information would be legally discoverable under the Local Government Official Information Act. Now, if it was declined, you'd lose the case at the Ombudsman, because there is nothing here, and the Ombudsman has set, with the Official Information Act since 1987, a series of precedents and rulings. And he has erred always on the side of
particularly local body and government information being made freely available. So it'll be released anyway. So I think there's no one here, it doesn't matter, it's the principle. And the principle is there is nothing here that we should be worried about, ashamed about, scared of, that is going to compromise any fully flow of information to the future. But it does provide for us a public accountability and audit of the decisions that we've made, the investments we've done, the way in which we have acted.
Okay.
So I so move. Oh, no, I don't need to move. I just vote against that motion.
Councillor Kempton.
Yeah, look, I want to be in a position where, if necessary, I can critically praise the performance of Deloitte or the performance of the BNZ. Now, of course, not being an expert, I might actually get that right. And I think it's quite important for us to be able to talk about the performance of those entities in a free and frank way. And therefore, we certainly the bit about their commercial reputation being besmirched in public, which you quoted, is in fact relevant. I don't want to, as I say, I don't want to talk about, because we shouldn't just be looking at the numbers saying, ah, the numbers, and distributing the numbers. We should also be talking about whether these agencies, although I know this is a lawyer, the relationship is through the Auditor General, but we should be able to have those kind of free and frank discussions interwoven amongst the information we receive, and we'll be bloody stupid to do otherwise.
Any other comment, Mr. Donald?
If I could, just through the chair. One of the things, a free and frank discussion is not a valid reason to move into the committee, and the sections that are listed there for each item are not around free and frank discussion. Like the point around the managed fund, although that's a statement of the position, it is commercially sensitive because it states what BNZ is going to do. And those things may or may not have been actioned yet. So it compromises potentially our position if somebody was to have essentially inside knowledge on what we are planning to do before we do it. Because they do go through and say that they do have the recommendations to rebalance the portfolio. So there is that. On the audit management letter, the issue there is that was issued to us as a confidential document by Deloitte. So we are adhering to their request for confidentiality. And again, that is a reason. That is one of the reasons. I mean, there is a list of reasons, and all of them are valid for why you can move into committee. It's not that you can go, well, only this one counts. These are the reasons, each section there is a reason. And the one on, in particular, in my director's report, around the BNZ controls report, I mean, you know, that is a BNZ document about how they internally run their organisation. That is incredibly commercially sensitive. And again, they have an expectation that's for us to consider, but not for the public.
Councillor Woodley.
Oh, look, I respect staff advice on these matters, and so I'm happy to move the resolutions that we go into committee.
Okay. I was going to second that.
I would just like to say that I support we're going to committee, but I'd just like to say maybe we should just have a wee look at it, perhaps have a talk to some of these people. Ideally, in an ideal world, we should probably try and make it as transparent as possible. But certainly at this junction time, I'm just trying to support that in the committee.
Yep. And just a quick comment from me in respect to that. I mean, I think too, in terms of the investment returns, I mean, in an overall sense, they will be reported publicly through the accounts anyway. But I've got a mover to go into PE. If I got a seconded by Councillor Robertson, all those in favour say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Against?
No. And could I have my dissent recorded?
Yes.
Excuse me, I need to.
Thank you, Councillor Robertson. Okay.